Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's episode, we are asking Al Jeaney why we need more jokes in our lives. I usually tell people that my favorite part of teaching is watching students engage in the process of discovery, seeing them encounter a new idea, get excited about the possibilities, and experience awe. But this is only half true. I really do love watching students discover, but my real favorite thing, my absolute favorite, is making the whole class laugh. I can think of few feelings that replicate the rush and fulfillment of getting everyone in the room to burst out in a huge guffaw. It creates a collective experience that transcends individuality and for a brief moment makes porous the necessary boundary between teacher and student. There is, if I'm being honest, a fundamental difference between the experience of student discovery and student laughter. The former is about them. It involves taking pleasure in the emotional connection to intellectual growth. Discovery is their reward for a job well done, and my enjoyment comes from empathizing with them. But the latter, the satisfaction I get from making students laugh, isn't about them at all. It's about me. It's a rush to the ego and my reward for a job well done. They are empathizing with me, not the other way around. The students won't laugh if we don't have a good rapport, if they are frightened by the subject or frustrated with the material, or if they distrust or resent me. Ironically, getting students to laugh is much more about being a good teacher than it is about being a good comedian. But there's a tension underneath my being funny in front of the classroom. My job is to teach. It's not to entertain. Lots of students complain that classes are boring, that they want their teachers to be more fun, and that instructors should work harder at keeping their attention. These demands are reasonable, up to a point. I do have a responsibility not to drone on, and I can't expect them to be enthusiastic if I'm not. But entertaining them makes students passive, not active, participants in the classroom. It makes me, not the course content, the objects of attention. And it's the course content that they should be focusing on. The best jokes in class, the loudest laughter, always comes from riffing off of the material we are discussing, not some needy attempt to have all eyes on me. The best classroom jokes shout, "It, not me." I cannot teach without humor. It's an essential part of my personality. But more important, I'm convinced that few people, if any, can learn without it. Sure, sullen and hostile classes can memorize and regurgitate. But to truly understand anything, to honestly internalize and comprehend any material, students must open their souls, whatever soul means. Plato recognized that intellect existed within the soul, but he thought that eros, desire, was the inspiration for soulful learning. I think he was wrong. Good humor comes before intellectual desire because being open to laughter requires being accepting of the unexpected. It necessitates lowering one's defenses and forgiving oneself for not knowing or for being wrong. The primacy of humor runs counter to how most people think about jokes in school. Jokes are silly, they might say, while school is serious. Humor is luxury. We've all been told at one point, but school, well, at best, it's a conversation with all those who came before us, and at worst, it's a necessary evil. But this way of looking at things disregards the place of humor in the human experience, the ways in which it provides insights and relief, connections and meaning, justification for and subversion of current cultural political norms. The best comedians, the most enduring satire, the most effective ridicule, is sophisticated, dependent on immeasurable amounts of background knowledge, and it's profoundly dangerous. On today's episode, we're going to give humor the credit it deserves. We're going to take a philosophical look at jokes and attempt to understand them, to ask what makes them funny, which ones are inappropriate, and why we need them in the first place. I hope to make you laugh during the process, as I always do, and I know my guest will try as well. But more than that, I hope to illustrate that we have all given way too little attention to one of the best and most important abilities that human beings have, to laugh at the world around us and to take pleasure in the absurdity that we all inevitably muddle through as we try to find meaning in our own lives and the lives of those around us. And now our guest. Al Jeaney is a professor of business ethics at Loyola University. He spent 27 years as resident philosopher on Chicago Public Radio's WBEZ, and he can still be heard on WGN Tribune Radio. He's the author of numerous books, including, most recently, The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. Al, thanks for joining us on Why.
Well, it's really a pleasure to be here. And after your introduction, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be here all week. That was just a wonderful analysis.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And of course, a lot of it was inspired by you. And I know our listeners are going to want to participate. We have pre-recorded the show, so we won't be taking any questions. But those of you who are listening want to send in comments, tweet us at Why Radio Show, post a comment on facebook.com/Why Radio Show, or visit our chat room at whyradioshow.org. So, Al, one of the things that people are going to discover that they probably already know is that talking about jokes is not as funny as telling or hearing jokes. What is it about analyzing jokes that takes away their humor?
Well, I think this goes really back a long time. You already quoted Plato. Plato said even the gods need a joke on occasion. But Aristotle pointed out at one point that there are three things we should do alone. He admitted a fourth: our toilets, our laundry, and our lovemaking. And perhaps our joke creation should be done in privacy as well. Jokes are public phenomena, but like making sausage, it's kind of a messy business doing it and not all that glamorous. But the real joy in it is the final product rather than anything else. E.B. White, a more modern scholar, said, analyzing humor is like dissecting a frog. Few people are interested in it, and the frog dies from it, you know? And I think that lots of things in life, including cooking, you know, the work is a great deal of drudgery. The real product is the punchline, the food itself, the moment itself. And so I think people forget comics work hard. You know, Seinfeld has a new thing out on Netflix right now, Jerry Before He Was Jerry, and he shows his tons and tons of paper writing jokes every day, day after day, cutting jokes, editing jokes. And jokes are work to get that punchline. You know, it's like a logical equation. Do I have a first premise? Do I have a second premise? And can I, from that, draw that third premise, that punchline? Nothing mysterious about it. There's a setup, a pause, and a conclusion. But getting there is a lot of work.
Is taking that step back from creation the joke, asking what jokes are, what makes them funny, is the philosophy even less funny? And I guess part of what I'm asking is, have you ever read any funny philosophy? And philosophers aren't funny people, right? We take ourselves very seriously, right?
No, they're not funny people. I like to think that the one chapter I have there about humor in the classroom, taken from former philosophy majors rather than philosophy professors, you know, Plato and a Platypus walked into a bar, that famous book of a while ago. Well, I think the problem here is the same thing with aesthetics. When's the last time you read a really interesting, beautiful book on aesthetics?
It's hard.
Or when's the last time you read a book on lit crit that said, wow, I want to go out and read that book? You know, I think the analysis kills the patient. And I think jokes that are too closely scrutinized fall apart, because jokes are, for a moment, the suspension of disbelief, right? The suspension to be caught in a moment, to see the internal logic without worrying about, is this exactly true? And on and on and on. And so I think that in reality, it's like, if you'll allow this gross analogy, it's a real difference between watching pornography and making love. And I think there's a real difference in the creation of jokes and joke telling.
Is it, does the joke require us to be, I don't know, irrational? Do we have to turn off? Is it precognitive is the word the philosophers use? Is it pre-reflection? Is it just instinctual? Is the laugh either it happens or it doesn't?
No, I think actually jokes resonate with our reason, but show the absurdity in the logical construct of the joke. Just like a simple one. Here's a simple Jerry Seinfeld joke, right? That is not totally rational, but it makes total sense, but it's also irrational because it turns – Jerry Seinfeld said a long time ago, you know, I never knew my voice had a tone until I got married. Kaboom, right? And so – it's totally rational. It's not irrational in the joke. Now, there are some jokes that are irrational, but because they are, they're based on incontinuity, incongruity. If you'll allow me this semi-naughty joke, I live in Chicago. The Cubs just won the World Series, or last year won the World Series. So the joke that came out of that I'm going to treasure forever is, what do you do with an elephant who has three balls? And the answer is, walk them and pitch to the rhino. that's an illogical joke. That's pushing an extreme. But it still makes sense when you step back and look at it.
So I'm having a weird split experience because some of the jokes that you're telling I've read in your book, and I laughed when I when I read them, and I'll probably laugh less now. But then there are other jokes that I tell over and over again, and I laugh every single time.
Every single time. Because there are classics. What's your favorite food? What's your favorite movie? Who's your favorite singer? We all have our favorites, and at the end of the book, and I won't do them right now because they're way too long, I give my two favorite jokes, my two absolutely universal favorite jokes. And I lie. In the book, there's actually my other favorite joke. And every time I hear it, every time I even think of it, I begin to chortle. So I do think that there are jokes that remind us that they were funny and remind us of the pleasure we had when we first heard them. And as soon as somebody says, hey, did you hear the one about, you know it, and you begin to laugh.
Is the nature of laughing different when you're telling the joke than when you're hearing the joke? Because I think that so one of my favorite jokes and my best friend's favorite joke is, why does a chicken coop have two doors? Because if we're
– I give. Why does a chicken coop have two doors?
Because if it had four doors, it'd be a chicken sedan. Right? Now I love that joke, but if someone
that's wonderful,
thank you.
It's wonderful. It's clean. You surprised me. You know, it's a Shaggy Chicken story. It's a great joke. It's perfect.
It's if someone were to tell it to me though now, I wouldn't laugh as much as me telling it to someone else. So what's happening there? It's not unexpected to me. Am I laughing at the past pleasure? Am I sharing the pleasure that that you just got from laughing? Because I feel great. Just laughed really hard, and I feel great.
Yeah, I feel great too. But, you know, if you come to my office 3 times a week for the next 4 years, I should be able to help you with this. But a quick answer right now would be that you've forgotten that there is pleasure and delight in the telling as well as the told. The person who hears the joke. There is... comics get up there. Jerry Seinfeld recently said this, and I'm not totally a Jerry Seinfeld fan. I've just seen a couple interviews by him recently, and it's kind of kicked off some ideas I've had. He said, I did this because I love doing it, because there was a rush for me. And so you talk to any comic right now, and he was talking about a comic that's no longer persona grata right now, Louis C.K., and his hardest problem is going to be that he's not performing because there is joy in the telling. I walk into – can I tell you the story why the book begins?
Sure, absolutely.
Perhaps this answers it. This book comes out because of my Uncle Joe. My Uncle Joe, until the week before he died, every time he saw me and he grabbed me for the embrazio, the kiss, the embrace, just before he kissed me on the cheek, he said, Alfredo, did you hear the one about? And he told me a joke. And rarely, if ever, did he repeat that joke. And somewhere in my teenage years when I rebelled against it, Uncle Joe, che cazzo fai? You know, this is all in Italian, by the way. It loses something in translation. What are you doing right now? Why are you telling me jokes? This is silly. He looked at me and says, Alfredo, and pushed away. He says, if I didn't love you, why would I want to make you laugh? Why would I want to share joy with you? Laughter is a gift. Joke telling is a joy. Share that joy with others and they'll be your friends. If and nothing else, they'll put up with you for a while. And until the week before he died, he did that. And I try to do that with my children and my grandchildren, even if they're the corniest jokes in the world. Grandpa's going to, hi, Grandpa, tell me a joke. You know what? It's a bond between us that I never want to lose.
But there are, right, other aspects of jokes, and you talk about them. I'm thinking in terms of defensiveness. Someone I know, a guy in his 70s, his father committed suicide when he was 13, and obviously this was very traumatic. And he had never visited – he didn't visit his father's grave until he was about 45 or 50. And the first time he did, he walked up to the tombstone, found the tombstone, and said, no, Dad, don't get up. Now, that's not – that's not for the deceased's, pleasure.
No,
although
for his own personal relief.
Right. So what's that about? If that's not about that bond, what's happening there?
You know, what's happening there is, you know, the Freudian analysis of the relief theory, right? God, let's not talk about the three philosophical theories of humor. It'll bore the devil out of both of us. We'll fall asleep doing it. But, you know, but Freud talked about that notion of that relief. You need, it breaks the tension. And the joke he actually used is a nobleman is being executed on a given morning, on a Monday morning, and as he's walking up the gallows, he looks to the crowd and says, well, this is a bad way to begin the week. Ba-da-boom, ba-da-boom, okay? His argument was that's we laugh at it because it's not happening to me. It's, you know, it's what were the old films of before, you know, the tower, the Burning Tower, Inferno, all those horror films. Right. Why we like them is because they weren't happening to us. I think we laugh at we need to create jokes and laugh at jokes because it gives us distance. It frees us. It lets us go. Your friend made peace with his father by saying that. He needed to say that. He couldn't say that straight. Dad, I wish you hadn't done that. My life has been terrible, but I forgive you. I understand. The joke, please, Dad, don't get up, did the same thing.
Why then are comedians so often really unhappy people, right? You cite Pagliacci in the book, but you also mentioned Louis C.K. Lots of comedians have committed suicide.
Yeah.
My wife knew a fair amount of professional comedians when she was in grad school. Many of them were struggling. What is it? Is it an attempt to make themselves happier? Is it an attempt to get approval? And the question I'm going to ask afterwards, and so I want you to think about this while I'm asking this, is can you separate the joker from the joke? Can Bill Cosby jokes still be funny, for example? But before we get to that, is there something special about the comedic psychology? Because a lot of comedians seem really unhappy.
Yeah, and I've worked with a lot of comedians, and I know you won't believe it with my corny jokes. I've actually written for some comedians. And yes, there are, a lot of them are a trouble lot. They're already jolly souls. But let me start off by saying I think many comedians, and Robin Williams perhaps personifies it exactly, he said, my humor comes out of my pain. Because there is so much pain in me and the world, I need to laugh at it. Well, Nietzsche said it perhaps best. And, you know, so you're, just in case your audience isn't aware of this, Nietzsche wasn't really that funny of a guy. No. I don't know if you've read much of him, but, you know, not a lot. You wouldn't invite him to a cocktail party. But he said, we have art in order not to die of the truth. Insert humor and the word art. We have humor in order not to die of the truth. I think that's why that motivates a lot of comics. Now, I want to make a real and important distinction. I know a lot of depressive comics, Shecky Green from years ago, when those comics were entertainers, and I think I make it clear in the book, and I think you'll understand this, there's a real distinction that's happened. There's a sea change that happened over the last 50 years. Stand-up comedy was created in America. That is a comic getting up, telling jokes without props, without this, without anything else, without singing or dancing, et cetera, et cetera. That was created in America. And by the way, that would mean that Jerry Lewis probably isn't a stand-up comic, although he is a comedian, okay? But stand-up comics started here. Until about 25 years ago, comedy was done in the tuxedo. And it was, you know, Shecky Green coming up there, or Shelley Berman coming up there, or my favorite Jewish comedian right now is, I'm blanking on it right now, forgive me, I have terminal jet lag, as I said to you. You know, he says, the secret to happy marriage, simple, dinner and dancing twice a week. I go on Tuesday, she goes on Thursday.
Sounds like Henny
Those
Youngman.
Those guys told Henny Youngman, thank you sure. so much. You get an A in the class, see me next week for extra credit. But Henny Youngman was brilliant. He did one after another with a violin in his hand, right? They got up there and they told you they were in the business of telling jokes. They weren't out to hurt anybody. Bob Hope, you know, Bob Hope's most snarly political humor was an Eisenhower doll. Yes, I got one for Christmas. You wind it up, it walks in the corner, and it does nothing.
I mean, that's actually,
you know,
really funny.
That was that was the depth of his humor. You know, probably half of your audience doesn't even know who Eisenhower is, but that's another story. But, you know, president of the United States. But those guys told jokes. And then, and here's the transformation. A guy called George, what was his name?
George Carlin. Yeah, George Carlin.
He starts off telling jokes in Vegas in a tuxedo. winds up as a hippy-dippy weatherman on the summer on the Summers Brothers show, and then becomes this social political critic, this satirist who help along with Mort Saul create what we understand by social commentary and political satire. Okay, these people began to reflect on life, and their issues are angry. Case in point, Bill Maher. He's funny, but he's angry. He's insightful, but he's pissed off. He's never charming, but rather you like his angst, that cutting edge. That's different from Jon Stewart, who, with all of that, still maintained the kind of gremlin-esque aspect, right, at that desk, et cetera, et cetera. I think a lot of comics are working out their own pain. And a lot of comics realize that their pain is the pain of others as well. So I'm doing you a favor right now.
So is humor a kind of existential medication? Is it a way that we deal with, try to make ourselves feel and be better?
Yes. Next question. No, yeah, yes. And by the way, existential medication. Can't we label that right now? Can you get your producer right now to get out and get a trademark on that right now? And we'll put anything in the bottle and sell it. I bet you we can make a fortune. But it is. Think about it. It is. When I tell you a joke, I'm sharing some joy with you. Or I want to make you joyful. Or I want to show you that I'm clever. Or I want to break the tension. Or I want to get through to you. I think it is an existential meditation. And you started off this interview with this wonderful analysis. I would take your class, but I'm too old. I think that was a wonderful analysis. Here's how I taught Heidegger.
So for our listeners, Martin Heidegger, German philosopher, mid-20th century, most famous book, Design and Zeit, Being and Time, in which he's...
Being and Time. So how do you teach Being and Time to reluctant 19-year-olds, even though they're philosophy majors? How do you even get to spell Design and Zeit, right? And so I couldn't get through, and I said, well, all right, let's try it this way. Here's a way to do it. I said, this woman who's been experiencing some difficulties goes to her family physician for kind of a checkup. And she's in there for a while, and he keeps giving her more and more tests. Miss Jones, I just want to follow up on this. And she's there for about 4 or 5 hours, and finally he enters the room and says, Miss Jones, I know you came in for a simple checkup, but I'm afraid I've done some really serious tests here, and I'm afraid that you've got a terrible terminal disease, and there's no chance for survival whatsoever. There's no known cure. And I'm sorry to tell you, you have less than 6 months to live. And Ms. Jones says, my God, it's not possible. He says, yes, it's possible. Is there nothing I can do, doctor? He says, well, you can do one thing. She said, what's that? I said, run out this afternoon and marry a CPA tax accountant. She said, will that cure me, doctor? He says, oh, no, but it'll make the next 6 months seem like an eternity. Boom, bada, boom. I'm working the room all day. They got it. Time is fluid. Time is flexible. Time is malleable. Heidegger is talking about our use of time and being used by time and being caught in time. That joke opened the door.
Does it make them take Heidegger less seriously, or does it add to his gravitas?
No, I think, can I quote a theologian?
You can do whatever
Niebuhr
you want.
thank you very much. I'd like a burger, fries, and a malt.
Okay, it'll be delivered after the show's over, though.
Thank you very much. He said that, Niebuhr said that in the face of the unknowable, the impenetrable, and the unacceptable, humor is another form of wisdom. And I think that I've really thought deeply about this. I'm trying to be serious now. Humor is not a cure for life, but it is a wonderful coping mechanism that lets us step from one existential crisis to another without being defeated by it. And the proof of that is Auschwitz. Victor, when I've been asked, I'm sure professors, students, and because you're on the radio, and because I've been, kind of a public intellectual myself and been on radio for years now, and as a resident philosopher on NPR, they'll say, well, what's the most important philosophy book you've ever read? And for years, I didn't know how to answer that. So I would say, well, let's start off with Socrates, and then we'll move to Plato and Socrates, then we'll move to Aristotle, and then, of course, we'll go to the Averroes, the translation, and then we'll move to St. Thomas. And you see their eyes glaze over, and they just walk away, right? Somewhere along the line, I realized the most important book I've ever read is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Viktor Frankl, PhD in psychology and philosophy, survived 4 years of Auschwitz and the death camps while most of his family was exterminated. And he talked about the need for humor to get through the day, the need not to sit around and tell jokes to each other, you know, did you hear the one about, but rather to find any moment of humor possible, to just have a moment of enlightenment, you know, of joy to continue on. The ones he relates are simple. His friend was knocked down by a guard on the capos and just beaten mercilessly. And the guard looked down and says, Schwein! And the prisoner looked up and says, Cohn, nice to meet you. That's not a funny joke to anyone except those there. That was an act of rebellion.
You know, I want to talk after the break more about this rebellion, but that also reminds me of a joke that holds the line. So, and again, it's a Holocaust-related joke, which I'm going to revisit after the break, which is a Jewish man is walking down the street in Vienna, and he comes upon Hitler, who knocks him on the head and sees a pile of dog feces on the ground. And he says, Jew, eat that. And he makes the Jew scoop it up and eat it and then walks away laughing. The Jew goes home to his wife and says, honey, you'll never guess who I had lunch with today.
I'm sorry. See, that's laughter in the face of horror.
Right.
That joke is persona non grata any other place. And we don't have the right to even use them except in this intellectual conversation. It's not our right to use that joke. But that joke helps sustain somebody through agony, misery, and evil that's incomprehensible.
And I want to pick up that thread exactly with another joke and with the tertiary questions about ethnicity and about forbidden jokes and about political correctness and all that when we get back. But for now, you're listening to Al Jeanne and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. I'm talking with Al Jeanne about jokes and the importance of being funny and asking why we need more jokes in our lives. And before the break, we started talking about a fairly heavy topic and the use of humor in the Holocaust. And I told one joke, and actually I'm going to tell another joke that's related that I had been planning on telling as an example of analysis. And it's as follows. It's World War II, and two Jews come across a map of Hitler's parade, and they decide that they're going to assassinate him. So they climb up on the roof, and they set their watches, and at 12 noon, he is going to march by, and they've got their sniper rifles. So they wait. They're all set. 12 comes by, no Hitler. 12:15 comes by, no Hitler. 12:30 comes by, no Hitler. One of the Jews turns to the other and says, gosh, I hope nothing happened to him. Now, that joke
is
laden with stuff, but one of the things that allows me to say that now is my long-term listeners know, of course, that I'm Jewish, and that gives me permission. And
right.
So I guess one of the
right.
questions I want right. to ask is this a rational way of dealing with jokes, saying only certain people can tell certain jokes to certain other people? Is that too limiting, or is that just how they work?
Well, you know, the answer to that is, here's the professorial, deeply thought out analysis that has taken me about 18 years to get to after perhaps consuming 400 books. Sometimes, or yes and no. And here's the point. You got the three rules of real estate are, Jack, please. The three rules of real estate, please.
Location, location, location.
And the three rules of comedy are audience, audience, audience. And I think the teller, the tale, and the told, and the timing of the joke are really, really critical. I think you need permission to tell certain kinds of jokes. I think certain kinds of jokes have a certain gravitas, like the death camp jokes. Have a certain gravitas that you really can't tell them. They're not funny except inside of that. And also the double ironic ones are not funny. I was having dinner with a friend and my grandfather had passed away. And my friend said to me, was that your grandfather a veteran of World War II? I says, yeah, he was. He says, well, my grandfather died in World War II as well. I said, really? Where? He says, he died in Auschwitz. I said, oh, well, that's horrible. He says, yeah, he got drunk and fell out of the tower and broke his neck. That joke is in one sense anathema est. In another sense, it's a way to spit in the face of evil, right? So I think you have to have permission. Now, I am partially Jewish. I am Italian and Jewish. I've got guilt coming and going. But I have to announce that when I do when I do certain Jewish jokes, because I want to use the accent, you know, what's the difference between how many Jewish mothers does it take to, you know, screw in a light bulb? And the answer is, no, that's all right. I'll just sit here in the dark alone. Don't worry about me, right? It isn't funny unless I do a little shtick there, right? So I do think there's what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. Everybody knows right now in this world, no comic tells a dumb blonde joke everywhere, anywhere, never, okay? Even if the blonde says, tell me those. I love those. No, there's probably somebody else there that does want to do it. I think the era of the confrontational comic, and he just died, and I'm blanking on his name. Don Rickles, that insulting, kind of confrontational thing. Yet he himself was a charmer. That's how he got away with it. He himself was this gentle beast, this gentle creature who Bob Newhart loves and adores, and who he himself, Bob Newhart, is this calm, gentle, loving creature. He got away with it because of his public persona. That persona doesn't work anymore. You can't do that. You know, you don't, there are certain jokes that are anathema est. But there are ethnic jokes that really, really, and here's my argument about ethnic jokes, that are really stories about all ethnicities, right? That are really stories about all of us all the time, about the mother experience, or stories about mothers. My favorite Jewish mother joke is an Italian mother joke as well. You know, the one about the son, again, let me use a little Yiddish accent here. Son calls his mother in Florida. Says, Mom, how are you? He says, oh, I've been sick, the mother says. Mom, what have you been sick? Oh, I've been terribly sick. I haven't eaten in 28 days. Mom, you haven't eaten in 28 days? Why? He says, I just couldn't. Mom, why haven't you eaten in 28 days? And the mother finally says, because, and the chance you should finally call, I'd have my mouth full of food. Boom, right? Those are really stories about moms, right, in some sense. You could put an Italian accent on that. But I do think there are jokes that are just, you have to have permission to tell them. I would argue, however, that an anti-Semite joke, a racially vicious joke, when told by an avowedly racially vicious person to a racially vicious audience, should not be told.
And that you point this out in the book, and you make an observation that I thought was very compelling, which is that those kind of jokes are actually a form of hate speech, and that we have to think of them as hate speech rather than jokes. Talk a little bit about that, because I thought that was a really useful filter for understanding the problem here.
Well, I do think it is. Even misogynistic jokes are really, in some sense, anti-women. And we have to be very careful about them. Now, we were just talking about the Jewish tradition. There's a whole series of, Jewish American princess jokes. Well, their initial, because I really looked into this, their initial origin, the real purpose was for a man to say, I make enough money to spoil my wife and my daughters. And my daughters and wives are special because I give them all this stuff. They're bragging. But that's not the way it comes off all the time, does it? And so I think we have to be very, very careful about jokes, because when we make jokes, even when they're funny, and here's the point, they can be funny. They really, really can be. A vicious, ugly joke can be funny. It doesn't mean we should laugh at them. It doesn't mean we should do it, because it perpetuates stereotypes and it perpetuates certain kind of hatred. Now, there are ethnic jokes that are so sweet. Let me offer you one that I recently heard that I realized it's an ethnic joke, but it hurts no one, and it really just shows up our similarities and differences. A couple is walking in New York City, and they see Lou Seinfeld's authentic Chinese restaurant. They said, "That's not possible. Lou Seinfeld? Authentic Chinese restaurant's not possible. Let's go in. I'm curious." So they go in, and there's a little man in a perfect little Chinese outfit standing at the door. I said, "Is this Lou Seinfeld's authentic Chinese restaurant?" He says, "Yes." The man says, he says, is he actually here? He says, "Yes, that's me." He says, "You're Lou Seinfeld?" He says, "Yes." He says, "Well, that doesn't make sense. It was a long story." He says, "When I came into Ellis Island, we were all in line there taking our names. The guy in front of me said, the guy in front of me was asked, 'What's your name?' He says, 'Lou Seinfeld.' And when he came to me and asked me mine, I said, 'Sam Ting.'" Hello.
Yeah. The philosopher here is processing and laughing. And of course, one of my reactions was, can I laugh at that joke?
Yes, but that's okay, no? Because we're talking about the wonderful differences between us. That's not negative. That shows that we are both same and different. You know, that's what I love. That's why I love the fact of, you know, what's the difference between an Italian mother and a pet bulldog? Oh, sooner or later, the bulldog lets go. Come on. That joke is every mother's joke. There are jokes that are edgy but not insulting or hate. There are jokes that are hateful. And there is one glaring exception, which I point out in the book, and I don't know how he gets away with it, but redneck jokes. You know, if you're a redneck, if you go to family picnics to pick up girls. How does he get away with that? Well, because no one thinks they're a redneck. Or being a redneck is a badge of honor, and so they don't mind it. But I do think when we give nasty Irish jokes, nasty, you know, the English tell jokes about the French tell jokes about, the Spanish and so on and so forth. When we tell the really nasty ones, we're really denigrating the people we're talking about, and that to me is hate speech.
You know, it's interesting because there's a joke going through my head, which now I feel obligated to tell, which
Please.
Sounds like it's going to be one of those, but a denigrating joke, but ends up being really, in my opinion, a wonderful, thoughtful joke, which is, and I have to clean up the language from the way I told it, but two firefighters, a fire chief walks in to the main room in the fire station and finds two firefighters having anal sex, two guys. And he's shocked. He says, "What are you doing? You're on duty. I can't believe this." And one of them, and they stop, and one of them says, "You know, look, I have to explain what happened. I walked in, and John was choking, and he was turning blue, and so I got the food out of his mouth, but he couldn't breathe." And so the fire chief says, "Well, why didn't you give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation?" And the guy says, "I did. How do you think this started?" And I love that joke. Two reasons. First, because someone told it to me in a synagogue on Yom Kippur. But also because
just because he was meditating on the eternal truths. Yes, I
right, right. But it was actually a she, and my friend Joy in California, and she's a listener. So hi, Joy. But also because what it reminds us is that it's love, right? It sounds like it's going to be an abusive joke insulting people who engage in homosexual acts, but what it actually is a reminder that it's
right.
love.
It's love.
Love, and it's beautiful, and it's fun, and you start kissing someone, and what happens next? It doesn't matter.
Right. I'm not sure it's beautiful at this point, especially in the station right there. I'm an old-fashioned guy. Like, you know, a lovely room, comfortable bed, cocktails, et cetera, et cetera. But, right, and the point is, no one's really hurt there. You're not denigrating them. But when you start to denigrate, and the example that the Amy Schumer joke a while ago.
Right, I was going to bring this up.
It's now 4 years old. By the way, I've seen Amy Schumer twice in the last 2 years, and I think she's a brilliant writer. I thought her first film was brilliant. And she's way too young and having that much talent. I've seen her over the years when she was still 22, 23. Her delivery, her coquettishness was adorable. Her timing was impeccable. She has a lot of talent. But I'm telling you the truth. I'm never going to see her live again until she changes her act, because I know more about her body and the exterior and the interior than I ever, ever, ever want to know, even if I was her lover. She's become totally sexploitation. Her argument is men do it. Why can't women do it? My argument is I don't go see those men. I don't want to go see you. But she knows how to tell a joke. She's part of that generation. And she's that with quick one-liner. She said, "You know, I've given up dating Hispanic men, comma, because I'm into consensual sex. And that brought down the house. Now, I would argue that the only person that could tell that joke is an Hispanic woman to an Hispanic audience. And I'm not even sure then. But that belongs to them, not to her. Now, her argument is I'm being an iconoclast. I'm breaking the rules to show up how stupid they are. I get it. Comics are supposed to be the canary in the coal mine. I get it. But, you know, good taste still applies. Timing still applies. Audience still applies. And so I think she crossed the line on that one. And that seems to be rather trivial considering some of the other jokes that are going around.
What do you say to someone who listens to the ethnic jokes or the jokes cross the line and they say, come on, it's just a joke?
Yeah, you know, that's the passport that's supposed to allow us to enter any land and say anything we want. No. Here's the simple rule. Do you tell your mother a lot of oral sex jokes? I don't. It's just inappropriate. The joke may be funny, but I'm not going to tell it to her. I mean, there's a certain privacy. I don't think you can say anything you want anytime you want. We are both professors. I'll bet not only have we told jokes in the classroom, and by the way, that's, I think, our comfortableness between us right now is predicated on some of your opening comments, because I, too, use humor in the classroom. And I know I got them if they laugh at the punchline that I've been working towards, right? That is, I'm not there to be a humorist, but I see a moment of humor in what we're talking about and bring that out. And if they get it, that means they got everything else before it. That is, we're inter-training them, right? That we're, in order to train them, to educate them, we got to get in. And sometimes the joke is the vehicle for getting in, just like the woman going to the doctor's office and saying you have 6 months to live. But I think that this is really funny. Oh, it's only a joke. Oh, no. It's not only a joke. It's called good taste. We could have a larger philosophical debate about this, but I think it's also called good taste and civilized behavior.
So this makes me want to return to a question that I asked earlier that we didn't get to. What you seem to be suggesting is, A, you can't separate the audience from the joke, but you also can't separate the joke teller from the joke.
No, that you can't.
And so where does that leave Louis C.K., Bill Cosby? Bill Cosby has this wonderful routine that which was very popular of people of my age group, where he's talking about making his kids chocolate cake for breakfast because it has eggs and milk and right. flour and all the things right. that are wonderful for breakfast. And I probably cited it once a month. And now, if I am absolutely compelled to, I'll say, you know, if I were allowed to tell this joke, I would bring up the Bill Cosby chocolate cake thing, and then everyone right. sort of laughs. But I'm not allowed to find Bill Cosby funny anymore.
Well, you know, Louis C.K. Probably has crossed over that line as well. And I thought, until these recent revelations, that he was simply, if not the king of comedy, the prince, the prince. That is, that he studied under Seinfeld, he wrote for Seinfeld, he opened for Seinfeld, and I think he surpassed Seinfeld with a younger generation. Jerry Seinfeld is 62 or 63, and he's a little gamey for the 30-year-olds right now, for the 25-year-olds right now, right? But Louis C.K. was right there, cutting edge, even though he's, I think, 48, et cetera, et cetera. I think we need a little time here. You're right. Bill Cosby, in some sense, was doing what Myron Cohen was doing. He got up and he told stories, ethnic stories, about the neighborhood, right? I love Bill Cosby stories about his father, you know, coming into the room saying to him and his brother, you keep this up, I'll take you out. I brought you in, I'll take you out, right? I mean, Bill Cosby's shows were not about black families. They were about families who were integrated. I mean, the show that I loved the most was when he was the doctor and the wife was the lawyer and the grandparents came over and they all liked each other. Huh? Right. Where's that right. family? And they all were beautifully dressed. I mean, in some sense, Bill Cosby was more than a black model. He was a model, you know. So, and I think we need time to use his jokes again. I think the teller and the tale become really close. There's a close fit. And when the teller is persona non grata, so is the joke for a while. And that's unfortunate, but it is true.
Is this an example of the theory comedy is tragedy plus time. Do you think that there's truth to that?
I'm going to go back on that. Can I do that? I'm going to quote the greatest Jewish philosopher that I know, and I'm sure you're going to agree with me.
Wouldn't that be me? Excuse me.
No, you're right there. And let's talk off air about when we can put our act together, right? But Mel Brooks says jokes are a defense against the universe. That life is so hard that God had, of every 10 Jews, he had to create one to be a comic. Otherwise, the lamentations would be awful and he couldn't stand it, right? A defense against the universe. And so I think that that's really, really, really key to understand, that we tell jokes to make life less bitter and a little better. Again, going back to Nietzsche, we have humor in order not to die of the truth. And so I want to say that humor is more than foolish fun. So your question again, say it again to me. Humor allows us, is a mechanism by which we cope better with life when the things we don't understand. Think about the jokes we make. Marriage, sex, relationships. These are ways of making fun of these things, these imponderables, these unavoidables in our life. But I lost your initial question. Forgive me. Please re-ask it.
I may have as well. I was asking about the connection between the jokes. But I want to be while I try to remember exactly what I asked you, I want to push this idea a second because you talked about audience being central and you talked about context. Aren't those people, going back to this notion that there are just inherently unethical jokes?
Yeah.
If the joke is dependent on context, if the joke is dependent on audience and teller, if jokes are so narrowly funny, doesn't that mean ultimately that they're not funny at all? And what I mean by that is if you have to be a Hispanic woman telling that joke about Hispanic men, or if you have to be a redneck talking to other rednecks, or if you have to be a Jew talking to other Jews, does it separate insider outsider in a way that is ultimately unethical because it divides human beings and it says, look, these people aren't going to find it offensive, so that's fine. And if everyone else finds it offensive, as long as they're not around, that's okay.
I think you're asking an epistemological question that can't totally be answered. And if we could, our audience would die of boredom along the way. But, and that was supposed to be funny with no response on your end. But anyway, I do think that we have to remember, linguistically and logically, a joke can be funny but still anathema-est. That's the real point here. It's not that it's not funny. It's, should it be told? Is it appropriate? Is it? Forgive me to use this word. I use it in the largest, most universal, kind. Is it edifying? And I don't try to say that terrible jokes, misogynistic jokes, pro-Nazi jokes, think of the worst joke you can imagine, aren't funny. The real question is, ethically, should they be told? Although I believe we have a comedic imperative to tell jokes to each other, that is to be, and jokes being kindness, if that's true, should we tell an unkind joke? Is that acceptable? And I think the slippery slope is we're in such a politically correct age now that everybody is offended by something. And I give this example in the book, and I think it's a brilliant example. I wish I had created the joke. I didn't. And it's about two guys in the Empire State Building having a couple of drinks, and they're getting pretty sloshed. And the one guy looks at the other guy and says, you know, we're in Empire State Building right now, but, you know, if you open that window over there, there's a current, and it's this backdraft. It's amazing. You jump out, and it just swoops you around the whole Empire State Building and deposits you right in this room. The guy looks at him and says, ah, come on, you got to be joking. He says, no, I'm not joking. He says, I'll bet you $100. He says, okay, you got it. I'll put it down. Okay. Guy gets up, opens the window, jumps out. 30 seconds later, he's back. He's back in the bar, closes the window, and sits on the bar. He says, how about that? I'll take my $100. He says, well, that's great. I'm going to try it, too. The drunk gets up, goes to the window, opens the window, jumps out, and falls 99 floors to his death. The guy gets up from the bar, goes over, closes the window, comes back to the bar, and the bartender looks at him and says, you know, Superman, you're a real jerk when you have too much to drink. Now, why would that be offensive to anybody? Superman's not real, right? Everybody knows you can't jump out of a building and fly around, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous people said, you're not being sensitive to the problems of alcohol. You're belittling this. You're not being da da da. You could offend. Everyone's got an ox to be gored, okay? And I think that as thinking individuals, we have to decide what's a bridge too far and make an ethical choice.
So you quote Jerry Seinfeld in your book saying that he doesn't like to do college campuses anymore because everyone is so politically correct. It's no fun anymore. And I really want to do
there's a whole series of comics, by the way. A whole series of comics.
And I really want to do a show on political correctness because I think it's interesting and I think the portrayal of it is problematic. Nevertheless, the question I have for you is you know, the argument from the students would presumably be we have learned things ethically. We have learned things about ethics, about people, and your jokes just don't fit that mold anymore. Your jokes, it turns out, are unethical. And the question I have for you is do jokes – lead the way in the ethical discovery, or does the culture lead the way and the jokes follow? And let me explain what I mean by that because I think it's a little ambiguous. There are lots of humorists, George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, Amy Schumer claims to be one, who think that their jokes will pull people along progressively to a better place. And then there are other people who say, no, you think you're doing this thing positive, but you're really behind the times. And the words you use, the jokes you use, the ethnic humor you use, you're just not with it. And so the question I have is, what's in the foreground? What's the front line? Is humor the front line, or is humor just reacting to the cultural front line?
I think serious satirists are social changers. And you know, George Carlin is a perfect point of that. He's Seven Deadly Words, right? Turn on cable TV. Seven Deadly Words are used morning, noon, and night, right? He changed acceptability. He changed social standards by the depth, the breadth, and the perceptivity. God, did I use that word on radio? Of his analysis of language. Am I wrong in that? Did he not shift everything over? Mort Saul, who nobody remembers anymore, who was 92 years old, by the way, still performing one night a week, was never particularly funny, ha, 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 fall down. But he was insightful and humorous and at one time called, you know, the patriarch of the new political comedy by Time magazine, I think, in 1965 or something like that. I think that comics can be game changers. And people like Amy Schumer, Amy Schumer sees herself as a game changer. She sees herself as a sexually active, vital woman making fun of sex and belittling some of her sex partners just the way, oh, God, this is a terrible example, Andrew Dice Clay has done earlier on and other male comics. I don't particularly like Andrew Dice Clay. I do like his present show right now on Showtime where he's making fun of himself now as an older man. I kind of like that, okay? He's satirizing himself. But I do think comics aren't always intentionally the social changers in our societies, but wind up that way more often than not.
Can humor decide the change that it wants to make? I mean, you know, when we have civil rights activists, when we have other forms of progressiveness, the activists target one particular thing and move forward. Yeah. Does humor work the same way where this joke is intended to liberate people about sex, about female sexuality? Or is it like literature, like television, in the sense that, yes, it may move forward, but not in the way that you predict? It's all unintended consequences.
Well, I'm not sure the full range of that question, but here's the part I get. Does humor generate more humor and more analysis because of the humor that it generated? And the answer is yes. Turn on nightly TV. All the five major shows at night, what's the topic of the shows? Donald Trump, political satire. I think humor generates social acceptance of terms and concepts, and I think a comedy like sports, like building automobiles, is a copycat industry when comic A starts doing jokes on X and that's funny, comic Y will play off that and comic R will try that. And there are better or lesser participants in the game. But clearly, Stephen Colbert has gone from being a stinker following up Letterman to number one on TV because he changed his format and changed the topic. Trump, as Richard Lewis Black has said, it's not fun being a comic, not funny being a comic anymore, not fun being a comic because I don't have to write anything. I just have to read the paper. And I think that comedians have embraced Trump. And to be fair, let me just say this very quickly. I'm not talking about Trump and his politics. I don't want to touch any of that. But like him or love him or hate him, he's certainly a magnet for satirical commentary. And they've jumped on that, and they've changed what we can say and what we do say about the president, right? Interestingly enough, Obama disarmed the comics by joining in with them, showing up on their shows and laughing with them, and also less of a magnet for satirical commentary.
Do you think that the comedians would have been able to push the Trump envelope as much if Trump himself hadn't changed during the campaign what a presidential candidate could say? If that notorious tape came out of him talking about sexual assault, if he hadn't pushed the envelope, could the comics have done it? Or is it, for lack of a better phrase, a symbiotic relationship?
I think it's a symbiotic relationship. But remember, the Trump before he ran for the president was a TV person. Was on Saturday Night Live, made fun of himself, had a popular television show, was kind of a comedic performer, right, in the real world. Then Trump, against everyone's expectation, actually winds up winning and then starts to say, "Here, I teach a course in leadership. I know I'm a philosopher, but I actually teach practical things. You'll forgive me for that, won't you? I no longer teach epistemology or aesthetics." So I'm teaching leadership. And my critique on Trump when I get to the presidential leadership is his gravitas, his sense of dignity, his sense of the office, his sense of appropriateness. That's what stirred everyone to go forward. I mean, yes, that tape was ground zero, but every day, look at what he says and look what's, you know, if Donald Trump in the morning tweets Tweedledee and Tweedledum, what's the headline in the New York Times? Tweedledee, Tweedledum. What does the president exactly mean by that? And that night, Stephen Colbert is going to say, Tweedledee, Tweedledum. I think he forgot the rest of the poem. Bum-ba-da-boom. Okay? I think he has let himself be a target. I think he did that initially on purpose.
Let me adjust this a little bit to ask. We've talked about jokes being funny. We've talked about the context. But then there's an attack that people use on the flip side of all this, where they'll say, you don't have a sense of humor. Feminists are often accused of not having a sense of humor. Vegans are often accused. A, why is that such a brutal accusation? And B, is it fair? I mean, it's not fair to say feminists are vegans because people aren't identical and everyone is different. But is it fair to accuse someone of not having a sense of humor?
Yeah. If I could disassociate myself from talking about feminists or vegans right now so as not to be stoned in my own home later this evening. I think the worst thing you could say of a person is they never told a joke. They never got a joke. They never laughed. I'm worried about their character because I think laughter and humor are a need and a requirement, as you were suggesting in lives, that humor offers us, you know, pleasure, offers us diversion, offers us a philosophical coping mechanism. And a person who doesn't get humor at any level is a person who is not a full human being. I think that humor is a virtue that we share with others. Now, I understand the buffoon, the classic definition of the buffoon is the one who never stops talking, never stops telling jokes, can never be serious. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about using humor as a means of communications and communicating and means of looking and analyzing reality, as your friend said at his father's grave, right? Even that insight that gave him permission and forgiveness to be there for himself, okay? I think when you really meet, and I've known three people in my life, and one of them, I won't even tell you how closely related I am to that person. I can't. I'm about to cry. Never told a joke. Never laughed at me. Never thought I was funny or anything was funny, and died miserable and mean. That's wrong. and I'm not going to die that way.
You know, there is such a fine line between laughter and crying, between the satire and our deepest emotions. You quote someone in the book saying that nothing shows a person's character more than what he or she laughs at.
Yeah.
And you just talked about virtue, where virtue is, in the Aristotelian sense, human excellence. And that there's something wrong. There's something painful about a person who can't laugh.
Right. See, I think Aristotle's right. Virtue is a habit that we developed, we acquire, we hone, because it adds to the excellent life. And not to laugh means you're not living an excellent life. You know the best thing in the world? Smiling at a child. You know the cruelest thing in the world? Laughing at a child.
I guess then I want to close with one question, and that is telling a joke an intimate act? You yourself have this emotional connection. I told various stories of things that are important to me. Are jokes inherently intimate? Do they reveal not only who we are, but who we can touch, who we can connect to?
Yeah.
Or are they just, is that just some jokes are, and some jokes are just, you know, they're, you can take them or leave them. What's the role of intimacy in humor?
I think it's double. I think that there are some jokes that are by nature intimate that you have to tell very quietly and softly. A joke that you tell a lover about a naughty sexual nuance that you can't tell to a popular, you know, to a larger group. The joke that my grandson's favorite joke right now, and I use it in the book. I mean, he loved it for years and years. I said, honey, did you see the story in the paper that this rhinoceros stepped on a grape? And he says, what happened? He says, well, the grape just let out a little wine. But boom, but you know, that to me is a precious joke because I laughed with him. I think jokes are intimate. Even when we tell in front of a crowd, when that stand-up comic is up there, he's making love to that audience. You paid money to see me. That's intimate. Believe it or not, that's intimate. That's why hecklers are a real problem. To me, a joke is a very – I won't tell you a joke if I don't like you. I don't want you to laugh. Why would I want to make you laugh? My Uncle Joe is right. To me, a joke – I started this talking about my Uncle Joe – is a bonding principle, a way to say I like you, and a way to ask you to like me. Ted Cohn, another Jew, right? That wonderful book on jokes, right? He said jokes are really gifts we give to each other to see if we like each other. And when a person doesn't get a joke, the joke didn't fit. Find them another one.
Or find another person.
Or find another person.
Al, Jeannie, this is a wonderful moment to end because it really underscores the human connection behind jokes and shows how much depth and how much integrity there are in jokes, and of course underscores the things that you were saying before, which is that jokes without integrity deserve not to be told. Thank you so much for joining us on Why.
This has been delightful. Imagine a philosopher actually reading a book about that, but this has just been delightful. I've done dozens and dozens of interviews, and this has been charming. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you, audience. We'll be right back after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Al Jeannie about jokes and why they are so important and why we need more of them in our lives. And in particular, I didn't bring this up, but in particular, we were talking about jokes, right? We weren't talking about puns or quips. There weren't a lot of one-liners. Al is very interested in the joke, the story, the setup, the punchline, as he discussed. And in the process, he said something that I think was really interesting and a game changer. We're talking about offensive jokes. And he said, they are funny, they just shouldn't be told. This is a different approach than most people use, right? Most people say, hey, you told that joke, it wasn't funny. And that's not an effective retort because it might be funny. And if you say it's not funny and it is, you lose all credibility. There's no truth behind there. But if you say, yes, that's funny, but it's hate speech, or yes, that's funny and it's inappropriate, or yes, that's funny and it's a weapon and you shouldn't tell it, well, then that makes it about the people, not the joke. It makes it about the relationship and the social use, not the joke. It makes it about the intimacy that jokes bring with them. It makes it about the social utility and the connectedness. Horrible jokes can be funny. They just shouldn't be told. The question is, how do we find the good jokes? How do we find the jokes that push morality forward? How do we find the jokes that enlighten us about our world? How do we find jokes that help us stare into the abyss, a phrase that Al used in his book? These jokes have all the virtues of the terrible jokes. They're intimate, they're insightful, but they're also kind, as he pointed out. Humor is a wonderful human gift. It is essential to the human experience. It is something, like all things, that we can think about intellectually, philosophically. We can analyze. We can ask why. We can ask how. We can ask when and where. And for my money, these questions make the jokes better, not worse. Yes, analyzing jokes isn't necessarily fun or isn't necessarily funny. But now that we understand them more, maybe we value them more. And now that we've put them, the jokes themselves, into our lens, maybe now we can laugh even harder because we know that they're substantive and that they too are virtuous. They are a form of human excellence. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Thank you for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.